Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been a pointed critic of what he calls the medical-industrial complex, as well as the blurred lines in contemporary medicine between profession and business. My guest is Dr. Carl Elliott, a professor in the Center for Bioethics and at the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He also holds concurrent positions at the University and the College of Liberal Arts. He's a noted bioethicist and an outspoken critic on the ethics and regulation of privately funded pharmaceutical research. He's the author of 7 books, including Better Than Well, American Medicine Meets the American Dream, and White Coat, Black Hat, Adventures on the Dark Side of Medicine. And his articles have appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and the New England Journal of Medicine. He'll be giving the John Hager Lecture for the University of Tulsa College of Law this evening at 6 in John Rogers Hall on the University of Tulsa campus. He'll be speaking about exploiting the vulnerable in medical research. And he joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Carl Elliott, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
A lot of your work in the last few years and a lot of your writing has involved looking at how medicine has transformed as it becomes more of a business than a profession. I think that's perhaps the philosophical way to think about the medical industry. And really, in recent years, you've been looking at how the vulnerable have been exploited in medical research. And I would like to start with a story that you've been very much involved with over the past few years. That's the story of Dan Markingson. Who was Dan Markingson?
Dan was a young man from St. Paul who was recruited into a research study of an antipsychotic drug called Seroquel at the University of Minnesota in 2004. And the reason he was recruited was that he had undergone a psychotic break. He was hearing delusions about demons and aliens. And most alarming of all, he thought that he was being called on to commit mass murder. And one of the people he was being called to murder was his mother. So he had been placed under a civil commitment order and was facing involuntary commitment when he was approached by researchers at the University of Minnesota, a psychiatrist named Steve Olson, about taking part in this research study. There were a few big issues with trying to recruit him into the study, a few big ethical issues. One, he was psychotic and very unlikely to be able to understand what he was consenting to. Two, he was under a commitment order called a stay of commitment that legally compelled him to obey the treatment recommendations of his psychiatrist, who was the same psychiatrist recruiting him for the study. And three, his mother, who he was threatening to kill, was very much opposed to him being enrolled in the study. She didn't want him in a study, thought it was dangerous, expressed her objections again and again, but he was enrolled anyway. And over the 4 or 5 months he was in the study, he did poorly, and she tried repeatedly to get him out of the study, warning that he was in danger of killing himself or killing someone else. And eventually that's what he did. His body was found in the shower of a halfway house. He had nearly decapitated himself with a box cutter, slit his abdomen from throat to groin, and was found with his arm in his abdomen and a note that said, I went through this experience smiling.
Oh, my gosh.
It turned out later that he was taking Seroquel, which was the drug produced by the study sponsor, AstraZeneca.
Now, I want to take it one step back. I think when at the time he joined the study, basically he was given two options. I mean, in practical terms, be involuntarily committed or join this study.
Well, he was on a... Basically, what had happened was he had been evaluated. He had been involuntarily committed by the court. But in Minnesota, there's an alternative to being locked up, and it's called a stay of commitment. And the stay of commitment allows you to avoid actual confinement as long as you obey the treatment recommendations of your psychiatrist. And so that is what his psychiatrist, Steve Olson, had asked for, and that's what the court had granted. But ordinarily, you would expect someone under a stay of commitment to be given standard treatment for their illness, not to be enrolled in a research study. That's no longer legal in Minnesota. As a result of this case, his mother, Mary Weiss, lobbied the state legislature to pass a law banning or at least severely restricting the ability of psychiatrists to enroll patients under a commitment order in clinical trials.
Well, I think it just seems to me that the thing you'd want to do in that sort of stay of commitment is basically to try to stabilize the patient in a non-institutional setting. That would be the goal of what you'd want to do.
Well, a non-institutional, if he doesn't need to be in an institution. I think part of the issue with Dan was that he was severely psychotic, and it's not clear that he was actually ready for discharge from the hospital.
Now, you mentioned that his mother basically repeatedly said, you got to get him out of this trial. What was the response from the research team? Because at this point, it was a research team, and how much day-to-day involvement did the psychiatrist have in Markinson's case?
Well, she tried pretty hard. I mean, she made phone calls, she left voice messages, she went to the Department of Psychiatry. She wrote, I think, 5 letters in total to Steve Olson and Charles Schultz, who was the co-investigator and the chair of psychiatry at the U, warning them about his deteriorating condition and expressing her worries. And she was essentially ignored. I think she got 1 letter back during those 4 or 5 months.
Now, when you hear about something like that, you would say, my goodness, that sounds almost criminally negligent. In fact, a lawsuit was brought. It was thrown out because the state, as a part, this was a University of Minnesota medical study under the auspices of that. It was thrown out as immunity. In fact, the state and the university tried to sue for legal fees.
Exactly, yeah. The court ruling was that as a state body, the University of Minnesota was statutorily immune from liability, which basically meant that no matter what the merits of the case, the university couldn't be sued. That was bad enough, but I think what was really outrageous was the behavior of the university attorneys afterwards, which was to turn around and file what's called a notice to assess cost, a legal action against Mary Weiss, demanding that she pay the University of Minnesota $57,000 to cover some of its legal fees in the case.
Wow. Now, even though this happened, how many years ago? Was this 2004? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Now, 2004. Aspects of this case is continuing to this day, in the fall of 2013. There's been an effort, and I think you've been a part of this, to get the state to do an independent investigation of what really happened and what went wrong. Because of this lawsuit, other than the law that Markinson's mother helped get passed, has there been any changes in how medical research is regulated in Minnesota?
No, there hasn't, and there hasn't been any admission by the University of Minnesota that anything wrong was done in the case. I mean, essentially, the reaction of the university, at least university officials, has been, we were cleared, the case was dismissed, we've been exonerated, and we're not going to talk about it. And so no matter what efforts are taken, no matter what media coverage there is, no matter what sort of protests come from people on the outside, they simply refused to discuss the case. So the case, even though Dan killed himself in 2004, the case didn't become public until 2008, which is when there was a series in the St. Paul Pioneer Press about his suicide. It really hasn't gone away since then. There have been a number of us at the university, faculty members who have been pressing to have something done. And then more recently, there was a letter to the Faculty Senate by, I think, about 175 academics at other universities, medical researchers, health lawyers, bioethicists, psychiatrists, led by an attorney called Trudeau Lemons, a law professor at the University of Toronto, expressing their alarm at what happened and asking the university itself to appoint an independent external investigation. And for the first time, back in November, a body at the University of Minnesota voted to take that seriously. The Faculty Senate overwhelmingly endorsed an independent external inquiry. But immediately afterwards, the president of the university said that while he would agree to an inquiry, it would not include any look at the death of Dan Markinson or past incidents. Hmm. So that battle is ongoing.
Obviously, this is an extreme example of exploiting the vulnerable in medical research, but is this an isolated, unusual incident on the face of it, or does things like this happen pretty regularly in America in medical research? Maybe not to this degree.
Well, I wish I could answer that, but I can't. And the problem is that, we just don't know. With privately funded trials, basically pharmaceutical industry funded clinical trials, there's very little oversight. And what little oversight there is private, confidential, proprietary. So getting information about incidents like these is extremely difficult.
In fact, I was reading something you wrote. You said the U.S. regulatory system is really built on the assumption that the main threat to public health in a trial like this would be from academics who are basically trying to, I guess, win the Nobel Prize. But really more and more of medical research now is done by private practice doctors from big pharma. And I guess there's very little regulatory oversight over these private practice doctors?
Yeah, that's basically right. So what began to happen in the early 1990s is that the pharmaceutical industry began outsourcing its clinical trials, not so much to universities anymore the way it used to, but to for-profit private entities, contract research organizations. Basically, private physicians in private trial sites who I think it's perceived, and probably rightly, are able to recruit patients faster for the trials and get the trials completed much faster and more efficiently than university doctors can. And so what we've seen since then is a move of these trials from academic entities to private entities. Now, when the current oversight system was set up in the 1970s, it was set up in response to sort of notorious research scandals of the day, most notably the Tuskegee syphilis studies in Alabama. And the idea, and basically the way the oversight system is set up, is to sort of with the assumption that these trials are happening in academic institutions and university entities. So the oversight system is basically a sort of review by your colleagues. Every medical school and hospital that does these trials has an ethics committee called an institutional review board, which is supposed to be overseeing the trials and protecting subjects. But when this trial started to move out of universities and into private contract research organizations, there's the question of, well, who's going to oversee those? And so you had the emergence then of a kind of private for-profit oversight system, so-called for-profit institutional review boards or commercial institutional review boards, or so they like to call themselves independent institutional review boards, mm-hmm. who review the studies in exchange for a fee. So that's basically a fee-for-service system. The sponsor pays the research ethics board to certify that its research is ethical.
Is the sponsor in many cases the drug company itself?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. That's where most of the drug research is done.
And I would think ethically, from a bioethics point of view, that's probably not one of the best ways to go about doing this.
Well, I mean, you don't want the entity being regulated to be paying the full salary of the regulator. And if it's a purely fee-for-service system in the world of the commercial IRBs, if a pharmaceutical company doesn't like the answer that they're getting from one IRB, they can just go to another one. If one IRB says, sorry, you can't do this study, it's unethical, then you should go to another IRB or another one until you get the answer that you want.
My guest today is Dr. Carl Elliott. He's a professor at the Center for Bioethics and also in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He also holds the current position in the College of Liberal Arts. He'll be giving the Hager Lecture on Health Law at 6 o'clock at the John Rogers Hall on the TU campus, looking at how the medical profession exploits the vulnerable in medical research. This Dan Markingson case has been compared to the Tuskegee experiment by some observers and ethicists. Again, you were saying it's really difficult because so much of this is in private hands. There's confidentiality agreements that are a part of this. Is there any sense that more episodes, maybe not this egregious, but where the vulnerable is really exploited as far as being a part of clinical trials? Can you give us maybe a couple examples that you know of?
Well, one area that I've been really interested in for the last 5 or 7 years or so are so-called phase one clinical trials. And basically, these are the safety studies that are done right at the beginning of drug development.
And this is about the practice. And, this is about the practice of what you call guinea pigging, or what they call guinea pigging.
Right. So, with a lot of these later stage studies, like the one Dan died in, you're basically recruiting sick people who have a reason to join a clinical trial. Namely, they might get a new treatment for their illness. If they're unhappy with the treatment that they're getting, or that it's not working, or the side effects are too bad or something, they may be interested in an experimental treatment. But that's not the case with these early stage, with the safety studies, because the safety studies are just done basically to see if the drug is toxic or not. So you've done your animal studies, you're doing the first studies in humans, and the first studies are to see how the drug behaves in the body and whether it's safe. Now, not many people are going to simply join a study of the safety of a new drug just to see how toxic it is. And so to get people to join these studies, essentially the system we have is that drug companies pay them. And so people who are interested in these trials will check into a trial site, usually for several weeks at a time. They'll eat there, they'll sleep there, they'll have their vital signs monitored, they'll have blood tests, they'll have urine tests, they may have invasive procedures, endoscopies, bronchoscopies, and so on, biopsies. And in return for that, they're given a paycheck. Now, not that many people are willing to do that, even for money. The amount of money that you can get paid is has been sort of steadily increasing. It's not unusual to see $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 for these studies now. And the people who have the time and the inclination to do that are usually people with no regular job or who are unable to get a regular job. And so you have people like people who are unemployed, traditionally college students, but more and more people who are homeless, people who, because of a criminal record, can't get another job, people who are undocumented and can't get regular work, basically people who are desperate enough to do this.
And in fact, I think I was reading your article. You said, in fact, the more invasive the procedures to test the safety of the drug, the more the volunteers get paid. And you found some people who just went from study to study.
Yeah, that's the world of the so-called guinea pig professional. There was a guy, sort of the pioneer of this, is a Philadelphia man named Bob Helms, who back in the 1990s started a zine called Guinea Pig Zero. And it was sort of the official organ of this guinea pigging subculture, people who do these studies in exchange for cash. Now, the thing that Bob Helms would always say, though, and the people who like him would say, is, you know, you can't mistake people like me for the typical person in these trials. So he and his and the sort of crowd of Philadelphia guinea pigs that you know that I talked to were educated people, very intelligent people, politically active people who were sort of living on the margins. But the vast majority of the people that they would do these trials with in the Philadelphia area were poor people, largely African American, and not people who were doing this by choice, but people who really had no other options.
In fact, I think Bob was very picky about what he did. He looked for decent accommodations, and what I understand is conditions vary in these sites. Sometimes they can be like an abandoned hotel where they, because you have to have these people confined as you're testing the safety of the drug.
They do vary quite a bit, and some of them are very good. I've seen trial sites where, you know, that are clean, where there's, wireless computer access, there's recreational areas, they've got PlayStation, they've got movies. And then there are the ones at the bottom end. And the most famous one, the one that you're referring to, is a trial site in Miami called SFBC International. And that site became notorious after investigative reporters for Bloomberg Markets magazine discovered it. And it was basically being run out of a converted Holiday Inn that had been condemned, in fact, in a very seedy section of Miami. And they had, for the previous 10 years, basically been recruiting largely undocumented immigrants to do these phase one trials in exchange for cash. And I think it's a sign of how poor and how porous our oversight system is that place, SFBC International, was able to operate in a condemned motel for nearly 10 years without anybody even noticing. In fact, the regulatory authorities, IRBs, the FDA, the Office of Human Research Protection, as far as I know, no one ever sanctioned SFBC over that. It was purely the investigative reporters who
shamed them.
Who were responsible for for shutting it down. Yeah. I mean, eventually the hotel was demolished. Hmm.
My guest today is Dr. Carl Elliott. He is a bioethicist, a professor at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in the Department of Pediatrics. He'll be giving the Hager Lecture on Health Law at the John Rogers Hall at 6 o'clock, Exploiting the Vulnerable in Medical Research. Well, what are some of the things, it sounds like where we're really seriously lacking is in regulatory oversight for a lot of this private research that's going on. What are the first steps we need to do in overhauling the regulatory structure?
Well, I think there are two big things. One is that you need to get rid of that conflict of interest. And by the conflict of interest, I mean both the conflict of interest in the institutional review boards within hospitals and medical schools and these private for-profit ones. The private for-profit ones, the conflict of interest is obviously financial. You can't have drug companies pay an ethics board to certify that their research is ethical. I mean, that's crazy. But there's a conflict of interest even, I think, within hospitals and medical schools. And the conflict there is more personal because what you have are faculty members and staff members reviewing the research of their colleagues. And these colleagues may be their friends. They may be their superiors, people with control over their jobs and promotion and tenure. And, there's just a tremendous incentive not to find research unethical as a result of that.
And I would think there would also be somewhat of a financial interest as well, because when you look at universities around the country, they're clamoring for research dollars. I mean, research is a highly competitive, finding money for research is a highly competitive thing for higher education.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, the transformation of clinical research into a market activity has meant that every research site has to compete with one another to get those trials. And so essentially universities have to behave in much the same way that private trial sites do. So they have to show that they can recruit subjects just as fast as the private trial sites can. They have to show that they can get the trial approved as ethical just as fast as the private trial sites can, or else the drug companies will just go to the private trial sites.
So that's one. Looking at the whole system of review boards, what was the other major change?
The major thing, and I think this could be even more important, the problem is that there's really nobody looking at these research studies on the ground. There's nobody actually going into the trial sites and looking and sort of checking out what the conditions are and what the trials, how subjects are being recruited, what the trials are like, and whether everything is being done on the up and up. The ethics review is essentially a paper review. The drug companies or the research sponsor, whoever is sponsoring the research, writes up the protocol, sends, you know, a big fat stack of paper to a committee that looks at the study on paper and decides if it's ethical or not. So they look at the design of the study, they look at the consent forms, they look at all the procedures and so on that the sponsor says they're going to that are going to govern the trial. But they don't actually, you know, for the most part, they don't actually go and watch what's going on. They simply trust the researchers to do what they say. And with so much money at stake, I don't think that that's enough. I don't think that you can simply trust multi-billion-dollar global corporations to do what they say based on a kind of honor system.
We don't in most other industries. Although the oversight is not terribly overwhelming in a lot of other areas as well. It's really interesting. We look forward to your lecture here in Tulsa, the Hager Lecture on Exploiting the Vulnerable in Medical Research. Carl Elliott, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Bioethicist Dr. Carl Elliott speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's a professor in the Center for Bioethics and the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. His most recent book is titled White Coat, Black Hat, Adventures on the Dark Side of Medicine. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa College of Law's John Hager Lecture in Health Law this evening at 6 o'clock at John Rogers Hall on the TU campus. He'll be speaking on exploiting the vulnerable in medical research. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa and you can search through our archives. And I thank you for listening. I'm Rich Fisher.